It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Welcome to the RTC Weekly Download. Today we're going to journey through an afternoon on the radio. We're going to start off with soap operas, and we're going to move through to the kids' shows, and after that we'll go to the evening program, which is going to be Dragnet. So if you're not too up on the first two selections, just pop over to the Dragnet. But there's something for everybody on this show. We're going to start off right now with our soaps, and here's the Goldbergs from 1941.
And now, the Goldbergs. Sometimes silence means yes, and sometimes it means no. But earlier this afternoon in Lastonbury, silence meant more than yes. It meant, I promise to marry you. And today, Molly Goldberg finds herself faced with the problem of turning Oriane's answer into, no, I can't marry you. You see, when Edward Way walked out of the Goldberg house with Oriane, he was on his way to see his former wife. But first, he told Oriane how much her love meant to him, and Oriane didn't have the courage to deny that she loved him. It seemed to mean so much to this man who's endured so many troubles. And now, as a call comes in for Oriane, Molly runs to call her.
Rosalie, what did I tell you to do with the wire? Did you let Dr. Cater hang? All right, Rosalie, I said something, you do 6 weeks. Oriane, you wanted on the telephone!
Papa said you'd catch a cold standing out here without a coat or a sweater on.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it very much. So why didn't you put something on?
Thank you. Right.
Give me my arm. Here. Give me my arm. Thank you very much. It's blowing up cold. My petunias, everything could be frozen.
Where is Dr. Cater calling from? Did he say?
He's still at the hotel with Mrs. Way, I think. Oriane! Do you want to down the telephone?
Why is she walking so slowly, Vi? But don't you feel the... Look how she's strolling just like a little dangerous eye. Look.
Go inside, Rosalie, darling. You're chittering, too. Go, darling. Go in. Rosalie, tell Dr. Cater we'll call back or he can hang yet. Go,
all right, Ma.
Come on, Reddy. Wait, lay down, Spotty. Lay down. Don't come here. I love you very much. Go away. Go away. Bother me like that. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Lay down, Spotty. Lay down. Oriane, Dr. Cater's on the telephone for you. She's on the telephone.
What is it, Oriane?
Something?
Huh? You don't feel well?
I didn't tell him, and I couldn't tell him.
Didn't tell him? Mr. Ray, you mean Mr. Ray said something?
Yes. A great deal. More than I should have permitted him to say. But I couldn't stop him. I couldn't, Mrs. Goldberg. What can you say to a man like Mr. Way when he tells you that you are the one that has given him back his reason for living? It wasn't just a proposal, something to which a woman can say no. It wasn't anything like that. Everything he said was said with a terrible fact of the prison behind it, the prison and the suffering. It was a man who had come up again from blackness and despair and the hatred of the world, and now he was saved. He claimed to be saved by me of all people. And he took it for granted that I loved him, that I believed in him. I couldn't say a thing, not a word.
All right. Leave it to Mrs. Goldberg. So something will be done. So stop. So you're not a baby? You don't have to cry? When he spoke to you this time, you couldn't say nothing. I can understand you couldn't say nothing. All right. So come in the house. Come in the house and we'll see. Just don't worry, that's all. Just don't worry. Come in the house.
Just 1 minute, Dr. Cater.
Tell him I'll call back. I'll be right down.
What's the matter now?
Shut, Jake, please.
Just 1 minute, Dr. Cater, please.
Give me Rosie, I'll talk.
More troubles for Molly.
Please, Jake, please. Hello? Hello, Dr. Cater? Well, this is me. This is me, Mrs. Goldberg speaking. Yeah, so... Orion will speak to you momentarily. Yeah, she came in. She came in the house. She's in the house, but she went upstairs. Well, she went upstairs because... Well,
She knew you was on the phone, but she went upstairs. It wouldn't be a second. Well, Dr. K, did you call you back? Well, I'm sorry. I know you was hanging up. Hello?
He hung up, huh?
Maybe he was hanging so long.
I don't blame Dr. Cato. Why didn't she take the phone?
Does Norian feel well? Not very well. Put up a little water, Rosalie. I'll make tea for everybody.
What mustn't I know?
I don't have to know neither. I'm not interested.
Make the tea, Rosie.
Nobody wants tea, Ma.
I want.
All right.
He spoke to her seriously.
Who? Dr. Kidder?
No, Mr. Ray.
What do you mean, seriously?
His only reason for living is hers.
Oh, I see. Do men over 40 still love with such a fire?
They don't.
Maybe. But I'm not such authority on love.
Why not?
Why not? I can't tell you. I'm not.
You never loved?
You I loved.
So?
So what do you want me to tell you, Molly, dear? I'm still burning. I'm smoldering. You're my smoldering ashes that will burn till I die. All right.
Why not? Why not? Orion?
Yes?
Dr. Cater hung, but I'll call him back.
Sit down, Orion.
Thank you. I'll call the hotel. The hotel, please.
Don't be so perturbed, Orion. Nobody over 40 dies of a broken heart.
Yes.
Mr. Ray won't either.
Mrs. Ray, suite, please. Yes, Mrs. Ray. I don't know how to spell it. Ray. Yes, here, Orion.
Yes. I don't want to speak to Mrs. Gray.
Then you'll speak to Dr. Cater, please.
Hello. Yes, Mrs. Goldberg. No, Dr. Cater isn't here. Mr. Way is here. Dr. Cater is left. Is there anything else? Goodbye. Edward, I suppose you're also disappointed because Dr. Cater isn't here.
A little.
You can find him at home.
What did he want?
I've asked him to be my physician.
What for?
He suggested it.
Why should you put up with it?
It'll give me something to do in this fatal town while I watch your antics.
It couldn't possibly be because both you and Dr. Cater are interested in Orion.
It might.
It's too bad he isn't here then. I'd like to take a burden off his mind.
Don't worry about his mind, Edward. Worry about mine.
Why did he want me here?
Well, you were the man who ruined my life. As my doctor, he was interested in seeing us together.
You still think I ruined your life?
I think of nothing else. And I have the same hope for what remains of yours.
Does the doc?
Very simply, I look forward to yours. I'm a wealthy woman. I've got the time and energy to devote to your career. And you're in the unfortunate position of being out on parole. Universally disliked, financially ruined, and in general not worth a penny.
But I'm still worth enough to make you bother.
If you've got a single hope of happiness left in you, it's too much for me to ignore. A person can forget many things, but not the humiliation of having loved, having offered, and being used the way you used our marriage for your silly career. Your career crashed, and so did I. I told you before, and I'll tell you again. You live in me, in every moment of my life, and I'll never get rid of you until I know you're finished.
And that's why you're here.
Yes.
You need a doctor, all right. But you need one without a stake in your cure.
I know what I need.
Well, I'm very sorry, Margaret. I'd like to be a gentleman, but I tried it, and it didn't work. So I'm going to be quite selfish and immensely concerned with myself. Unfortunately for you, you divorced me when I went to prison. That put a legal period to our lives together. It's over. All you can do now is think.
You're very confident of yourself, aren't you?
No, I'm not. But I'm confident of something else. Someone else. It gives me more strength than self-confidence can.
You're dreaming dreams about Orion Leland. But don't flatter yourself. She won't marry you, a man like you. She wouldn't give her son a father who's an ex-convict, a fraud, a thief, a man who would be afraid to walk alone in the streets of our old city. You're fooling yourself, Edward. You're forgetting Dr. Cater.
Orion has promised to marry me.
I don't believe it.
We're going to get married, Margaret. So you can pack up and leave. And if you like, you can take Dr. Cater with you. All this because Orianne couldn't speak. In such circumstances, Jake's blunt attitude is much better than Orianne's sensitivity, but the thing has started.
As the tears flow on millions of women listening to the program, we have yet another soap opera in mind, this time Mama Bloom's Brood, 1934.
Well, 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 here's Mama Bloom's Brood. Harold Fink has moved into position both as Mama and Papa Bloom's son-in-law and vice president in charge of sales at the knee pants factory, which you know has a uniform department, a creation of Sidney, the other son-in-law. Just now we find Mama Bloom entering Harold's office at the factory where she finds Yetta.
Why, hello, Ma. What are you doing here?
What am I doing here, Yetta? Why shouldn't I be coming down here?
Oh, I was just surprised to see you come into Harold's office.
To tell the truth, I'm a little surprised myself. To me, it looks like something from that movie, The Lost Horizontal.
Horizon, Ma.
One or the other. Pop will faint when he sees the fancy furniture. Just like Sydney's it is. The chairs you can't sit in and a filing cabinet.
Filing cabinet.
Why do they need such fancy things? 20 years ago, when I came to see your pop at the office, I had to sit in his chair. One chair was enough for him.
Well, that's a little old-fashioned now, Ma.
No, a chair is a chair no matter if you make it out of wood or out of gas pipe like this. Is he going to give a party that he needs all these chairs?
Oh, no, Ma. They're going to have a conference.
Uh-huh. Something new that your papa don't know about.
Well, I think Sidney and Harold told him about it this morning.
Mm-hmm. What did Papa say?
Oh, I don't know. Harold didn't tell me.
Maybe it was that you shouldn't hear it. Yetta, your papa's heart is like a house, I know. But remember that you can drive a horse to water, but you can't get him wet. Papa likes the uniform business now, but other things I don't know.
Well, Harold and Sidney are planning to take a lot of worry off Papa's shoulders.
Yes, darling. For 20 years, Papa's been in business. He likes to be in business. When he's in business, he worries. He keeps his head full of things to worry about, and that makes him happy.
Well, I don't see how worry can make a person happy.
Well, there are different things to worry about. Some things are not good to worry about, but business is. If your Papa would come home in the evening and I would say, Jake, how's business? And he would answer, business is better than it has ever been. Then I would know something is wrong. I would know that business is not good. I would know that he worries more to keep me from worrying.
Oh, I see.
No, you don't see. You won't see until you're older yet. When Papa's worried, then I know everything is all right. So you shouldn't take worries away from Papa.
But Papa isn't getting any younger.
Yet, that's foolish. Who is? It's a good thing we don't get younger, because if we did, then we would do crazy things like we did when we didn't know better. Getting older helps.
Oh, I didn't mean that. I meant that younger people have newer ideas about things.
Only because they think they do. 20 years ago, it was 23 skidoo. Today, it's scrunch.
Scram, Mama.
So they both mean the same. We think them different. Did you see Papa?
Uh-uh. I came right in here to wait for Harold.
Where is he?
Well, Sidney called him on the dictaphone a few minutes ago, and Harold went to his office.
Yet, I didn't hear what you said. He called him on what?
The dictaphone, Ma. It's there on her desk.
A new kind of telephone?
Well, it's like a telephone.
That little box there?
Mm-hmm, that's it.
How does it work, like a radio?
No, you push this little lever down over the name of the person you want to talk to, and it buzzes in his office, and you just go ahead and talk.
You don't even have to call a number?
No, of course not.
I could talk to Mrs. Fink?
Not on that.
So what good is it?
It's just for inter-office communication.
Yeah, maybe we should stop before I'm crazy.
Never, Sidney.
Oh, Papa.
Now, Becky, what are you doing here? Go home before you are crazy.
Jake, what's the matter now?
Where are those two schlemiels?
Harold and Sidney.
And who else would I be calling a schlemiel?
Harold's with Sidney, Papa.
I know. One is always with the other. And when they're together, they're thinking up new ways to spend money.
Jake, don't get yourself hexed up.
Head up, Ma.
With an ex or a tea, he's excited. What for, Papa?
What did they do, Pa?
Do. Mama, I'm running around in circles, trying to catch up with those two.
You'll get dizzy. Sit down, Papa.
Sit down there.
On a chair. We don't play games that you should sit on the floor.
Better that I should than on this furniture.
But, Pa, it's lovely.
Lovely. She says it's lovely. In a factory, things shouldn't be lovely. They should all be business.
Ain't business good, Jake?
I don't know anything about the business. I have only been in it for 20 years. Sam and me, we have been here for 20 years, but we don't know anything about it. Sidney and Harold, they do.
Did they say so?
Oh, Papa, give them a chance.
Chance. Yet too much chance I gave them already. This morning, I'm sitting in my office and a man comes in.
A customer?
No, not a customer. Oh. Sidney sees the customer. The customers all think I am dead. But I am sitting in my office and a man comes in to fix the dictaphone.
Ah, so you got one too?
I didn't ask for it, so I get it. When I ask Sidney what it is, he says that we should talk to each other through it.
Of course, that's what it's for.
Sure, Jake, it's a new invention. Not every Tom, Jake, and Abe could have one.
Then why should I have one? To call customers, it's no good.
Of course not, Pa. It saves steps in the factory. If you want to talk to Sidney or Harold, you just buzz him.
But why should I want to talk to Sidney or Harold?
Now, Papa, you'll get yourself a headache.
My daughters gave me two headaches. Headaches that got names. Now I should have a dictaphone in my office. When I wanted to talk to somebody, I walked. When I wanted to talk prices with Sam, he came to me or I went to him, whichever was the closest.
It's no joke, and time goes on.
So the prices for these things. Look around you. This is Harold's office, with his name painted on the door. Knee pants are not fancy, so why should we have fancy offices like this?
The uniforms is fancy, Papa, like the red one Sidney sold.
All right, Mama, we won't say any more about the uniforms. Sidney is a smart boy.
So is Harold.
But just one thing they forgot to tell me. They forgot to tell me what a vice president in charge of sales does.
Oh, so that's what's bothering you. Why, he arranges contracts for sales, and he sees that the salesmen attend to business.
Then Sam is not on the road. I am. Who should tell us to attend to business when we own it? If we are foolish enough not to attend to business, then it's time we had somebody to tell us, but not before.
Papa, maybe you can sit back now and be an executioner.
You mean an executive,
all right.
The way I am feeling now, I could be both, easily. Oh, I wish Sam would come back from the road. I'm afraid to show him what is going on. He is selling knee pants on the road, and behind his back, Sidney and Harold are spending the profits on furniture and dictaphones.
Maybe Sam will like it, Papa.
Yeah, to the eye, it looks good. But to the pocketbook, no good.
Oh, look!
Yes, but who? Oh, how'd you scare us? What's the matter?
Oh, nothing. I just happened to see something in this magazine I was looking at.
At a time like this, you have to look at picture books.
Oh, but look at this, Pa. It shows different offices of different executives. Oh, look at this one. Just like Harold.
Let me see. Just like Harold.
Yeah.
It's pretty, Papa. Come and look.
If it's just like Harold's, I could sit here and see it. Besides, the price might be on the page.
Just look at the vault. Finished in nutty pine.
That's naughty pine, Ma.
If it's like Harold's office, your mama was right.
Oh, here, Pa, look. I'll read over to you.
Yet I don't want to look. Why should I keep on hitting myself over the head with a hammer?
Papa, don't get excited all over again.
Now, here's an office you should have, Pa.
Why should I have one like that? Is it fancier than Sidney's and Harold's?
Of course. It belongs to the president of the company.
The president? But I am not the president.
Look at it, Jake. A telephone all shiny with mercurochrome.
So, a telephone like that should be different. If I quote prices for a job, lot of knee pants, the price comes out of the other end of the regular telephone just the same. Does the price get fancier because the telephone does?
You should have an office like this one, Pa.
I don't want it.
Oh, listen to what it says, Pa. The typical office for the up-to-date executive who realizes that his office is the first impression a client gets.
You see, Papa, you want to make a good impression.
Now leave that to the uniforms and to Sidney and to Harold.
Oh, think how important you'd feel in an office like this, Papa.
Yet I am important only to the knee pants business. Only the knee pants business is important to me. It makes no difference if I work in a cellar in a monkey house like this. Knee pants is still knee pants.
But with the uniforms, you should have something match. Something like this office.
No.
Jake, don't be like a Victrola. One no is enough.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Are you crazy like a March herring?
A March hare, Ma.
Yeah. I'm going to see Sidney and Harold.
Say, do you know whose office this is?
Yetta, it's Harold.
No, I mean the one in the magazine.
Whose is it?
Isidore Cohen's. You know, he's the one who married Harold's aunt.
Ida Goldfarb was her name before she was married.
Ida Goldfarb?
Yeah. You should know her, Jake. You took her to Coney Island.
I took you too, Mama.
Yeah, sir. Her husband has an office like this, huh? And he gets a picture of it in our magazine.
Does he do as much business as I do?
I'm a golfer.
I am going to find Sidney and Harold.
You're going to stay here, Jake.
Mama, I can't. Every minute I'm away from Sidney and Harold, they're spending money.
Jake, don't make the same excuses. 15 times you said that and you stayed sitting there. But as soon as I mention Ida Goldfarb's husband and his hobbies, you want to go away.
Mama, Ida Goldfarb's husband is not in the knee pants business.
So what difference is that? A business is a business.
Then what difference is the office?
To me, it's a lot of difference when Ida Goldfarb's in the argument. You are going to get an office like this, maybe better. Instead of the chairs being made from gas pipe, they'll be solid.
Mama, two offices like this are enough.
Jake, maybe sometime I'll meet Ida Goldfarb.
Then you will say hello.
Sure, I will. But before I say goodbye, she'll say, how's Jake? She'll come here to see Harold's office. And then she'll maybe want to see your office. So I will take her down in the cellar where the furnace is and say, this is Jake's office. No, Papa.
Yetta, why do you have to look at magazines?
Papa, don't change the subject and don't blame it on Yetta. I'm not trying to spend money for you, Papa. I'm proud of you. I want to stay proud of
Mama,
you.
Mama, all I
Wait a minute, Jake. A long time ago, I married you because I was in love with you. I still am. So I want you to have everything fine like other people.
Mama, when you talk like that, then I don't remember one little word I should know.
Jake, what you saying?
I am saying that I should remember to say no, but I can't.
Uh-huh. Maybe I should get new dresses, new hats, new shoes. But I don't think about that, Jake. If either Goldfarb's husband should have an office like this, you should have, because he's no better than you.
Nobody said he was.
Maybe other people would say it, because they're not married to you. You see, Papa, two people who are in love with each other don't need anybody else to tell them they're fine people. But other people don't know that. So the two people who are in love have to wear good clothes for other people to see from the outside. The inside, only the people who are in love care about.
Mama, I don't know what you're saying.
I'm saying you're going to get an office like this.
Well, maybe I will. I think I will, if it pleases you.
I said before, it don't please me. It pleases other people.
Oh, hello, everybody.
Hello, Sidney. Harold, Sidney.
He'll be along in a minute, Yvette. How do you like the new office, Ma?
Beautiful, oh, lovely.
Well, I'll have to get Harold started off on the right foot, you know.
Maybe I could help with a push.
Sidney, how long does it take to get an office like this?
Oh, not very long. Why?
Papa's going to get one.
Oh.
Oh, maybe you don't like me to have one, Sidney. Maybe you would like two pretty offices for yourself.
Oh, no, Pa. After all, it's your business.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. You know, for a while, I thought I was somebody else. Maybe only a visitor around here.
But you won't need the office for a while.
Sidney, you're getting to something.
Yes, and it will cost me money.
Well, no, not exactly.
Sidney, tell me, please, before I go crazy, what have you thought of now?
Well, Harold and I were talking, and we figured out that the business is running along smoothly. I know the ropes, and Harold's getting acquainted pretty fast, so...
So what, Sidney?
So we thought you could retire.
Well, we're listening to an afternoon of old-time radio, and in our fictitious listening session, it's late in the afternoon now, so Mother's gone into the kitchen to start with the dinner. The kids are home from after school, and of course, it's time for their programs to start. Here's one of them, Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, the secret of the Yucatan jungle.
Jack Armstrong,
the All-American Boy.
Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them how we stand. Ever shall our team be champions, known throughout the land.
Wheaties, breakfast of champions, bring you the thrilling adventures of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Attention, fellows and girls. Stand by for a Jack Armstrong sport flash and hear the actual voices of today's great baseball champions. Only 2 hours ago, the American League Yankees became champions of the world by defeating the Brooklyn Dodgers 3-1 in the fifth and final game of the 1941 World Series. Today, Jack Armstrong's salute to champions goes to the entire Yankee team for their championship performance throughout this exciting and hard-fought series. Every Yankee proved himself a real winner. Joe DiMaggio, Charlie Keller, Red Rolfe, Joe Gordon, and all the others turned in top-notch performance in every game. But here's a piece of news that ought to make you sit right up and take notice. In just a few seconds, you'll hear the transcribed voices of three of these world champions. First at bat is Charlie Keller. Charlie, I hear you've got two sons. Do they go for Wheaties just as much as their father?
One thing I've noticed about Wheaties is that when a ball player starts eating them, you're pretty sure to have his family having Wheaties every morning, too. At least that's the way it happened at our house. Mrs. Keller and my two young sons, Charlie and Donald, really go for their Wheaties. Fact is, the Keller family is for Wheaties 100%. And I think that Wee's favor is the reason.
Thanks a lot, Charlie Keller. And now, Red Rolfe. Red, how do you like your Wheaties served?
Both Mrs. Rolfe and I agree that bananas and Wheaties make a mighty fine breakfast dish. We've tried other fruit with our Wheaties, but we always come back to bananas. Of course, during the berry season, we like Wheaties and cream with raspberries. I guess you could say that we like our breakfast of champions with just about any fruit.
Well, thanks, Red Rolfe. And our next world champion is Joe Gordon. How about it, Joe? We know you're a great Wheaties fan, but we'd like to know just how you like those Wheaties served.
To tell the truth, I think Wheaties taste mighty fine with just about every kind of fruit. I've tried them with sliced bananas, sliced peaches, berries, and lots of other kinds of fruit. And I don't play any favorites. Just give me a bowl of Wheaties with plenty of cream and fruit, and I'm happy. Ask my family about that.
Thanks, Joe Gordon. Well, there you are, fellas and girls, the transcribed voices of three of today's great baseball heroes. Now, why don't you take a tip from these champions and start eating the finest flavored dish I know every morning? That means a big bowl of Wheaties with cream and your favorite fruit. Man, there's a dish that's packed to the brim with the swellest flavor you've ever tasted. But don't wait. Ask Mother to get you Wheaties right away, and then join the hundreds of champion athletes who eat Wheaties every morning. Remember, it's Wheaties, breakfast of champions. And now, Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Jack Armstrong and his friends are about to take off from the Hudson Airport in their amazing strato ship for the wild Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. They are going there on the pretense of searching the jungles for a lost city of the ancient Mayans. The real reason for their trip, however, is to investigate the activities of a sinister secret society of Central America called the Yami. They believe that the Yami, working with a lawless group of fortune seekers, is planning some drastic action which may seriously endanger the United States. Whisper has just returned from the Yucatan, bringing back a semi-precious stone containing a message in Mayan hieroglyphics, which was being sent all over Central America. An agent of the Yami has been desperately trying to recover that stone, but now Jack Armstrong is holding it in his hands as he stands by Uncle Jim's large stratosphere amphibian plane. Uncle Jim and Whisper are in the plane, installing the television scope, which records distant scenes on a small screen. And Billy and Betty are watching the sky for the approach of a small plane containing a most important visitor. Listen.
Gee, Whitaker, Jack, if that Professor O'Neill doesn't get here pretty soon, we'll be gone.
No, we won't, Billy. Uncle Jim will wait for him. After all, he's flying here all the way from the east to look at that stone.
But why did Uncle Jim send for him, Jack? Uncle Jim was able to read the hieroglyphic message on the stone.
He could read the message, Betty, but he couldn't quite figure out what two stars the message referred to.
What suffering catfish, Jack? What difference does it make if we don't know what two stars it referred to?
Oh, it makes a whale of a difference, Billy. The Mayan priests used astronomy to fix their dates. And when they say that two certain stars or planets will be in a certain position at a certain time, well, that's fixing a date.
And we've got to know that date, Billy, or we won't know just when all this trouble is going to start down in Central America.
Hey, don't be so careless with that stone, Jack. Golly, you're holding it just as casually as though it were a piece of quartz.
They'll have a hard time getting this stone away from me, Billy. Look at it. Just like an egg made out of a precious ruby. And look at those hieroglyphics engraved on it.
Well, I've looked at them so often, I think I can even read them. At least I know what they say.
Well, shucks, we all know that, Betty. Let's see now. It says, obey him who brings this stone. When the fire star rides with the king of stars, the bearded gods of the east will come in thunder and lightning, and the feathered serpent will return.
But what it really means, Billy, is that there's going to be a lot of fireworks exploding in Central America soon, and the people had better look out.
Oh, I do wish that professor would hurry and get here so we could get started. Well, look, Uncle Jim and Whisper are stepping out of the status ship now. They must have the television scope all installed. Are we all ready to go, Uncle Jim?
All ready, Betty. As soon as Professor O'Neill arrives. Can't understand why he's late.
Private plane left hours ago.
Well, I bet those fellows who tried to steal the stone from us have something to do with his being late.
But maybe those strangers heard that you had sent the Professor O'Neill, Uncle Jim. Maybe they prevented him from coming.
That's barely possible, Betty. I did send for him by radio to the university. They could have been listening in at the time, but it's not likely.
Say, Billy, why don't we get in the stratoship and turn the television scope towards the east? We may be able to see him.
Well, that's a fine idea, Jack. Then we'll see if Uncle Jim and Whisper haven't started all right.
Go to it. But first, give me that stone, Jack. I want to study it some more.
Yeah, here you are, Uncle Jim. Come on, Billy. Let's see what we can pick up on the television scope. Now tell him what we may see. Here, you go in first.
All right, Jack. Jumping, Jimmy. Just look at all the supplies we've got stored away in this ship.
Well, we're going a long ways, Billy. And we won't find stores in the lost city of Yucatan. Get in, Betty.
I wish we were 10 miles up in the air now instead of still waiting for that old professor. Oh, be careful, Billy. Are you sure you know how to work that television scope?
Oh, jumping crickets, Betty. You'd think I'd never even seen it before. I turn on this switch here and point the telescope to whatever I'm looking at. Then I turn the focus screw and whatever I'm pointing at will appear on this ground glass screen. See?
But there's nothing on the screen, Billy.
That's just what I'm pointing at, Betty. Just empty sky. Now I'll swing it around to the east. And if there's an airplane anywhere in that direction...
Why, Billy? There's something on the screen now. Here, let me adjust that focus screw a little.
Oh, Billy, look. Look on the screen.
It's an airplane, Jack. It's an airplane flying this way.
No, it's not very clear yet. I'll try and get a better focus. There, that's better. Say, we can see every detail of it. It's a little cabin monoplane.
Oh, it looks so near. I bet I can see it with my naked eye.
Oh, I bet I can too, Betty. Say, that's funny. I can't see a sign of it when I look out of the cabin.
It's too far away to see much with your plain eyes, Billy. Oh, move over a little. Uncle Jim's coming in.
I think we've sighted Professor O'Neill's ship.
Oh, have you, Uncle Jim? Is it his ship?
I don't know, Betty. Never seen a ship before. As a matter of fact, I've never met Professor O'Neill before. I know him only by reputation. He's world famous for his knowledge of the ancient Mayans.
Oh, I can see the plane with my naked eye now, Jack. He'll be here in a minute. Let's get out to meet him.
Hey, get easy, Betty. Don't break your neck before we get started. All right, Billy, you're next. Watch our steps. Come on, Jack.
All right, Uncle Jim. Hey, I hope Professor O'Neill can tell us about those stars in the message. Look, Whisper. There comes Professor O'Neill's plane now.
Splendid. I always wanted to see a flying professor. I trust he's not absent-minded. I tried to step out of the clouds, you know, and find there was nothing to it. Frightful predicament, but...
can't you ever be serious, Whisper? Here we're going to learn something awfully important.
And I still bet my boats, Betty, that something will happen to him before he lands.
It'll have to happen pretty soon then, Billy.
I would, Jack, but that's the way things happen when the army are at work. But I fancy the learned professor is safe now. He's set his ship down. He's taxiing toward us.
Well, he's an excellent pilot for a professor. But then he's flown all over Central America investigating the ancient Mayan ruins. Watch it, Billy. Don't let him run you down.
I'm all right, Uncle Jim. Say, he's going to come right up to us.
Jack, he looks just like a professor. Why, he even has a long beard.
He looks too real to be true, Betty. But don't let him hear you. He's stepping out. He's trying to decide which is Uncle Jim.
I am Professor O'Neill. I presume
I'm Captain Fairfield, Professor. We're afraid something had happened to you.
And I'm still afraid something's going to happen, Jack.
Billy, I understand that you wish me to examine a most unusual stone containing Mayan hieroglyphics.
That's right, Professor O'Neill. It's this red stone shaped like an egg. If you look it over...
What's the matter, Jack? Why do you look that way?
What's that doing? Oh, nothing's the matter. I just had a queer feeling that I've seen Professor O'Neill before.
But you can't have seen him before, Jack. Why, even Uncle Jim hasn't seen him before.
I know, but he certainly reminds me of somebody.
I say, Jack, he reminds me of somebody, too. Couldn't be the bearded lady of the circus, could it?
Oh, do be serious, Whisper. He's trying to read the inscription on the stone.
I suppose you can translate the inscription, Professor O'Neill.
Of course, of course. But I understand you have already translated it. Why do you want to consult me?
I couldn't identify the two stars it referred to. Perhaps you can.
Why do you want to identify them? May I ask why these stars are so important, Captain Fairfield?
I think they're important because they fix a certain date, Professor O'Neill.
A certain date? Date for what?
I can't tell you what the date's for, Professor. But it'll help us very much if you can identify those two stars.
I will do my best. The symbols for the stars are rather complicated. But I have a magnifying glass in my ship. I shall study the stone under the glass and see what I can find out. Pardon me a moment.
Why can't he bring the magnifying glass out of the ship and study the stone where we can all see him?
I fancy the old bird desires solitude for his profound study. My word, he's even closing the door to his ship.
Oh, look, Jack. He's caught his beard in the door of the plane. He's trying to get on loose.
Holy mackerel, look. His beard has come off. Uncle Jim, look at him. He's not a professor. He's the parachuter who was here before.
Oh, he's going away with the stone.
Get in the stratoship, all of you. We're all set to take off. We'll follow him and see where he goes. Quick now.
Oh, Uncle Jim, do you think we can catch him?
Of course we can catch him, Betty. But I don't want to. Not yet. Yes, get in the ship.
I get you, Uncle Jim. We'll follow him and see where he goes.
That's right, Jack. Come on in, Billy. We fly way up above him in the stratosphere, where he can't see us. We'll keep him in sight with our television scope. And we'll find out where their hideout is in this country. Is everybody in?
All in, Captain Fairfield. I'll close the door.
I'll take the controls. Fasten life belts, everybody. Here we go.
Has begun with a bang. Suppose Jack Armstrong does discover the secret landing field to which the small ship is flying. What can he and the others do then? Well, there's one thing you can count on. They're flying right into the middle of the most exciting adventure that's ever happened to them. And you won't want to be left behind when they drop out of the sky to that secret landing field. No, sir. So, listen in, all of you, at this same time tomorrow, to another thrilling episode of The Secret of the Yucatan Jungle with Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. Now, if you want to discover how downright extra special good a breakfast can taste, I'm advising you to help yourself to a big bowl full of Wheaties. Those Wheaties flakes are nationally famous for handing out a winning flavor. And I want you to get your share of it. Put in your bid for Wheaties right away.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the brand.
This is Franklin McCormick saying goodbye until tomorrow for General Mills, makers of Wheaties, Breakfast of Champions, who have just presented another episode of Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy.
Bye, Wheaties. The best breakfast food in the land.
And the kids quickly jump from their seats to grab for the radio tuner to get their favorite program on. One of them gets to it first, and he picks Dick Tracy from 1947, The Case of the Big Black Box.
The following program is transcribed.
And now, Dick Tracy!
This is Dick Tracy on the case of the big black box. Stand by for action. Let's go, men. Yes, it's Dick Tracy, protector of law and order.
Tracy fans, long ago, when there were no big cities as we know them today, New Year's Eve was celebrated by dancing in the streets, singing, the ringing of church bells, and lots of merriment. Many people welcomed in the new year in their homes. Well, the custom hasn't changed very much. Nowadays, there are usually one of two ways that people celebrate ushering in another year. Folks attend watch night services in churches all over the country. Other people celebrate with carnivals in the main section of town. Or they have gay parties in their homes or in hotels and restaurants. Here in New York City, both these ways are celebrated on a big scale. There are famous, impressive services uptown at Riverside Church, which end with the carillon ringing in the new year. But in glamorous Times Square, hundreds of thousands of people throng up and down Broadway with noisemakers of every description. A few minutes before midnight, there's a stillness on the Great White Way as chimes ring out to Auld Lang Syne, old folks at home, and other favorites until midnight. And then the noise breaks out all over again, greater than before. For Tracy fans, tomorrow starts another year. Let's all try to make it a happy one. And now, Dick Tracy. On the train that was speeding them toward a 3 weeks vacation, Tracy and Patton met a fabulous character named Oompa Papa the Great. Oompa professed an ability to cure any illness. And from a desire to learn more of his activities, Tracy persuaded Patton to acquire a sudden and unknown malady. Oompa prescribed a cure in his California Salubritarium. As yesterday's episode ended, Dick and Pat discovered that they'd been locked in their room in the Salubritarium.
Tracy, the more I hang around with you, the more I regret it.
Don't be bitter, Patrick.
Will you give me one concrete reason why I shouldn't be?
Well, pretty soon it'll be New Year's Eve.
You say that as if I was supposed to be happy at the prospect of greeting 1948 from a couple of rooms in an isolated mansion on top of a mountain in Southern California, in the rain.
Well, aren't you?
It's beneath my dignity to answer that.
I'm anxious to see Oompa Papa the Great.
Oh, yeah, he's a lot of laughs. If he comes in here, I'm going to blast him.
No, you're not, Pat. You're going to be Pat Paragon, who's very sick and hoping that the Oompa can cure him.
Oh, Dick, listen, let's knock off this masquerade.
Not until we've solved the Oompa's racket.
All right, I'm getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And this time I'm not kidding, I'm starving to death.
Well, Rusty Blade, the butler, said he was going to send us some food.
Sure, he also said he was going to hang up our clothes. So what did he do? Swipe our guns and lock us in here.
Now look here, Pat, calm down for a minute and be practical. Oompa Papa the Great.
Hey, Tracy, do you believe that name?
Will you listen? Oompa, as I was saying, must be in this racket to make money. He thinks you're a rich man, and he also thinks he's convinced you that you're sick. It's to his advantage to keep you happy and keep you duped. In a little while, he'll be along with some golden words and some food.
Oh, keep talking, Richard. I feel better already.
And what's more, the food should be good. Something he'd eat himself, like unsalted crackers and distilled water.
Oh, you black-hearted mistake for an officer of the law. I believe you joined forces with the Oompa to drive me crazy.
Honestly, I haven't, Pat.
Then why am I the poor guy? Why do I have to pretend to be sick?
Because you're such a good actor.
Well, of course, you have a point there.
The whole success of trapping this fellow devolves on you.
Hey, but wait a minute. Supposing this guy isn't just in it for money. Supposing he's nuttier than the Waldorf salad. What then?
Well, then we'll just have to shoot it off the cuff.
Yeah, the only shooting we'll do will be with our cuffs. He's got our guns. And while you're playing with your cuffs, I'm likely to be taking the Oompa's treatment in that electronic gizmo he's talking about.
Oh, you mean the electronic thermodynaminator and cosmic health dispenser.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's the thing that he sells. That's his racket. I'm anxious to see how it works.
Well, I'm not. It'll be lots of fun, won't it, to see me sitting in the thing and Oompa Papa the Schmapa hooting and hollering around and pulling switches while my knees are slapping together and my hair is pointing north to the magnetic pole and lightning shoots out of my ears.
It'll be magnificent, Pat.
Well, I wish you'd get some other guinea pig to try it on.
Now, Pat, you'll feel better after you've had your crackers.
Oh!
And at another part of the Salubritarium, we find Oompa Papa the Great and his remarkable butler, Rusty Blade.
Well, how long are you going to keep him sweating, Oompa Papa the Great?
You have a rare gift for objectionable language.
Thanks. And that's the perfect answer to my question, I suppose.
I shall graciously bestow my presence on the Messrs. Richard Tracer and Pat Paragon in a few moments. If they worry a bit now, the greater their relief when they see me.
Yeah, sounds smart enough to me.
I wish you to have food sent to them right away.
Okay, what do we give them? Wait, Spock?
Not tonight. Give them a real meal. It will put them in a more receptive mood to part with their money.
Well, are these guys loaded?
Of course. I wouldn't have lured them here to the Salubritarium if they weren't. If things go as I plan, I expect to separate them from about 10,000 in the next couple of days.
Doing good.
Of course. 10,000 is cheap enough for a person to pay to regain his health.
Is that Irish one really sick?
I have persuaded him that he is. I've played enough suckers to know the words they want to hear.
Yeah, I know.
Oompa Papa the Great knows everything.
Oh, forgive me. Every once in a while I forget.
Yes, you do. What's that?
Search me.
Who's guarding the gate?
Fritz.
If someone has broken in, I'll have Fritz flayed alive. Quick, hide behind that curtain. We'll see who comes. If I signal you, grab him.
I got you.
Who's there?
It's me, Harris. Oompa Papa the Fake.
Mr. Harris, what is the meaning of this intrusion?
I just thought I'd drop in to see you. I thought you might be interested in knowing how I was.
You hardly seem in a condition to call on anyone, Harris.
Really? Isn't that too bad?
How did you get in here?
I walked in. Your guard down at the gate seemed quite willing to let me pass.
I don't believe you. Anyway, I shall have him investigate.
Yes, why don't you do that, Umpa?
Harris, I actually think you are ill. At least your mind seems to be somewhat unbalanced.
That's always possible, Umpa.
I am called Umpa Papa the Great. I do not tolerate contractions.
That's a great pity, because you may have to listen to some this evening.
I think you'd better go.
I'll go when I'm ready. When I'm not ready. I have a few things to say to you first.
Either leave or I'll have you thrown out.
I don't think you will.
I refuse to debate the point. You'll find out soon enough. I'm sure you'll excuse me now. I have much to do.
Stay where you are, Umpa. I'm in no mood to humor you.
Oh, so now we are going to play with guns, are we, Mr. Harris?
Yes, we are. And I'm an excellent shot.
That's very possible, but why do you want to make me a subject for your skill?
Just possibly because you deserve it.
You are a fool. Put your gun away and get out of here.
I'm going to make a call to the Los Angeles General Hospital in a little while. And I may or may not have to use my gun on you, depending on the answer
I get. You're talking in riddles. As I said before, I think your mind is deranged.
Yeah. You'll think differently when I tell you that my wife is a patient at the hospital.
Oh, so that's it?
Yes, that's it.
Your wife's sickness has nothing to do with me.
On the contrary, it has everything to do with you.
Huh?
Right now, she is dangerously, probably fatally ill. The doctors say that if she'd come to them several months ago, there'd be no question but that she'd be well.
Ridiculous.
But she didn't go to a doctor. You got to her instead. And talk that phony line of yours.
That.
And heaven knows you're excellent enough.
Your wife probably didn't follow my advice.
She followed it all right. That's why she may be dying now.
That's a lot of nonsense.
There's one other little item. My wife is a charity patient at the hospital. Because my life savings went to buy that electronic gadget of yours. I told her not to get the thing, but you had her so duped that she thought it would cure anything.
I have never made such claims for the electronic thermodynaminator, nor have I ever attempted to diagnose a disease or prescribe for one. Just remember that.
Oh, I know. You're very careful not to break any laws.
Of course.
And that's why I'm out here with this gun. I'm going to break a law. The one about murder. If my wife dies.
You rattle like an hysterical old woman. I'm bored with it.
Don't move!
I have no intention of moving. But it's time Rusty Blade did.
I think so, too.
Thank you, Rusty. Take the gun out of the way. He's trying to reach it.
Everything's under control, Umpa Papa. Don't make a move, Harris, or I'll slice you like a salami. They don't call me Rusty Blade just because of me hair.
Well, this makes my record for failure 100% perfect.
I'm going up to the West Wing to see our guest.
More suckers on the hook, eh?
Rusty, you will come up as soon as you can and bring their dinner. The chef will have it hot in the oven.
What'll I do with Harris here? Take him outside and push him down the mountain.
Oh, great heavens, no. I can't afford to let him loose now. He can't touch me legally, but he can make a lot of unpleasant publicity. We'll keep him until tomorrow anyway. Maybe forever. Give him the bridal suite, the one with bars.
I dig you, Master Umpa Papa.
You know, I've heard of starving explorers eating their shoes, Richard. I wonder what they taste like.
I don't know, Pat.
Well, we'll find out in a minute, because I've reached the point where a boot looks very tasty.
If the shoe fits, put it in.
Oh, even your bad puns can't distract me. You know something? I'm hungry. Whoever that is, I'm going to eat them.
Good evening, gentlemen. Welcome to the Salubritarium.
Greetings, Umpa Papa the Great.
And how are you feeling, Mr. Pedagon?
Me? Oh, I'm getting weaker.
We greatly appreciate your hospitality, but the truth of the matter is that, well, neither of us had a chance to eat before we came up here, and we're both quite hungry.
Well, I had anticipated that, and I have ordered an excellent dinner for you.
Dinner? Well, you wonderful, wonderful man.
Of course.
Oh, look, it isn't going to be just crackers, is it?
Oh, crackers. No, tomorrow you shall start a diet, but tonight... Tonight, you will have everything.
Leave me alone, you! If I ever get out of here, I'll kill you and him both!
Good heaven, what was that?
Did you hear that?
What was that? Just a dramatic record that I was playing for some guests.
Oh.
Yes, that's very interesting, don't you think?
In a moment, we'll return to Dick Tracy. But first, what a wonderful addition to ABC's great lineup of Wednesday night hit shows. It's the star-studded Tony Martin Show. Yes, starting tonight and every Wednesday night, the lively, melody and mirth-filled Tony Martin Show will follow the Bing Crosby Show over most ABC stations. For melody, there's the popular, romantic voice of Tony Martin, and then, of course, there's the lass with the delicate air, lovely Evelyn Knight, who's famous for her special interpretations of beautiful folk ballads. But that's not all. You'll also hear the music of the Victor Young Orchestra and the Jeff Alexander Chorus. In the Tony Martin Show's last department, I think you'll roar over the hilarious antics of comedian Alan Young, who specializes in getting into riotous predicaments, predicaments that would have anybody but Alan at his wit's end. But when you hear him, you'll agree that there's no end to Alan's wit. Well, here's a program that you're sure to enjoy, the Tony Martin Show. The Tony Martin Show features Alan Young with Evelyn Knight, the Victor Young Orchestra, the Jeff Alexander Chorus, and Jimmy Wallington. So be on hand when it's on the air on most ABC stations tonight at 10:30 in the East and 9:30 elsewhere. And now back to Dick Tracy.
You see, Mr. Harris, it don't do no good to go yelling around. I get so excited that I beat you up.
First, my wife. And now myself.
Harris is not the only unfortunate who have been caught in the Oompa's grasp. And what of Dick and Pat? What can they do? Better be sure to tune in tomorrow for The Adventures of Dick Tracy. Produced by Charles Powers. And this is George Gunn speaking. One farewell that won't be sad will be ABC's farewell to 1947. Especially tonight's great Bing Crosby New Year's Eve show. Bing's welcoming two guest stars to help him celebrate. Comedian Danny Thomas and Rudolph Schmohopper. Schmohopper was supposed to appear on a recent Crosby program, but he failed to show up. Just what he'll do on tonight's show is being kept a secret. But there's no mystery about the laughs you'll enjoy with Danny Thomas. After a battle of quips, Danny and Bing will enact a riotous musical sketch that we hope will keep you in stitches. So don't miss Bing Crosby's great New Year's Eve show when it's on most ABC stations tonight.
The preceding was transcribed. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Now we arrive at the primetime portion of our broadcast day, and we're going to have our primetime program, which is Dragnet, The Body Buried in the Nursery. This is from September 3rd of 1949.
Pet Milk Show, usually heard at this time, has moved to a new time period on Sunday nights. Be sure to hear Larry Douglas and Kay Armon on the new Pet Milk Show tomorrow night on NBC.
And now, here's another in NBC's great parade of new shows.
Gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
NBC brings you Dragnet.
You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned to a homicide detail. A man's wife has suddenly dropped from sight. On the surface, it appears only as a routine missing persons case. You start to investigate. Suspicion grows. There is evidence of possible foul play. Your job? Find the woman or find her murderer.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. Investigated and solved by the men who unrelentingly stand watch on the security of your home, your family, and your life. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Wednesday, September 15th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We were working a day watch out of Homicide. My partner's Ben Romero. The boss is Ed Backstrand, Chief of Detectives. My name's Friday. I was on the way back from lunch, and it was 12:56 when I got to room 42. Homicide.
Hi, Joe. Waiting for you.
Hiya, Ben. Al.
Hi.
I hear you got something for us.
Here's a report right here. Gardener by the name of Eric Kelby called in day before yesterday. Said his wife disappeared from their home out in the valley Sunday night. Says he thinks she left him.
That happens every day, Bargetti.
Not this way, it doesn't. Walsh and I went out yesterday to interview the guy. Story doesn't add.
Why not?
None of her clothes are missing. None of her luggage. She even left her pocketbook behind, full of money. Found out from the neighbors a missing woman is a 17-year-old boy by a former marriage.
So what?
An only child. Mother dotes on the kid. Shouldn't even say goodbye to him.
How did this Eric Kelby impress you?
Pretty grouchy with Walsh and me. No cooperation.
Wants to find his wife, doesn't he?
I don't know if he does or not. It's no help, I'll tell you that.
Can I see that report a minute now?
Oh, here you
are. Agnes Trumbull Kelby, age 39.
Kelby's her second husband. First one died a little after the boy was born.
Mm-hmm. Disappeared Sunday night from her home, 546 Belasco Road, between 7 and 8 o'clock. When did Kelby call in?
Monday afternoon. Said he thought his wife might be spending the night with her sister. When he found out she wasn't, called us.
Did you meet the boy while you were out there, Borghetti?
Yeah, that's another thing. Kid came riding in on a bike while we were talking to one of the neighbors. Tried to talk to him, but the old man came out hustling him inside the house. Then he starts eating us out.
What'd he say?
Told us it was our job to find his wife, not to go prying into her stepson's affairs.
Well, that's a new slant.
How about her friends and relatives around here, Al? Any besides her sister?
Walsh located a couple of her aunts. I don't think he's checked them yet, though. I'll tell you, boys, this is one I'll bet on.
Maybe. You got the names of Mrs. Kelby's relatives?
Yeah, right over here. Sure wish we had a chance to talk to that boy.
Yeah. How's it feel to you, Ben?
I don't know. Notice anything else funny about the guy, Al?
I don't know. Here's those names, Joe.
Thanks.
Kelby was upset, all right. For some reason, he didn't strike me as reacting the way a normal guy reacts when his wife disappears.
All right, Al. How would you react?
Bargetti's worrying again.
Oh, now listen, boys. It's no fooling matter. This is one I'll bet on. It's a homicide.
All right. How about a copy of this report?
Where did I get the phone? Missing persons, Bargetti. Who's that? Yes. Yes. About what? Oh, sure. All right, son. 4 o'clock. Yeah. Goodbye. That was Kelby's stepson.
What'd he want?
Thinks something's happened to his mother.
In police work, missing persons detail is not a department separate in itself. It is organized as a part of the Homicide Bureau. According to Bargetti, who took the call, the boy said he suspected his stepfather, and he didn't want him to know of any meeting between him and police officers. He would meet the officers that afternoon at 4 p.m. in a restaurant on the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Fairfax Avenue. At 3:15, Ben and I left the office and drove out to the meeting place, the Dairyland Fountain and Coffee Shop. We arrived there at 3:45. At 8 minutes to five, the Kelby boy still had not arrived.
Youngster's not very prompt.
Well, let's wait a little while longer.
Yeah. Well?
Yeah, thanks.
Want some more coffee?
No, thanks. I guess the boy isn't going to show.
Think something's happened?
15 minutes after we left the coffee shop, we drove up in front of the gate of the Kelby Nursery on Belasco Road. The house itself was set well back on the property, which covered about 4 acres. The entire nursery was surrounded by a 6-foot steel wire fence, and it looked like almost every available foot of ground inside was planted with some kind of a flower or shrub. Kelby met us at the gate.
Yes? What do you men want?
Police officers. Are you Mr. Kelby?
Yes. What do you want?
Well, if you'll shut those dogs up for a minute, we'd like to ask you a few questions.
I'm busy now. Can't you come back tomorrow?
It's pretty important, Mr. Kelby. I think we better talk right now.
All right, if you have to. Red, Giant, down. You too, Jaime. Quiet.
All right. Now, what do you want?
Mind if we come inside?
Well, these watchdogs of mine are pretty vicious. We can talk here at the gate.
All right, Mr. Kelby. This is Sergeant Romero. My name's Friday. We've been assigned to look into your wife's disappearance.
Oh. Did you find anything yet?
Nothing definite. Maybe you can help us. Would you tell us exactly what happened the night your wife disappeared?
What do you mean, what happened?
Well, when did you last see her? When you first noticed she was gone?
We finished up Sunday night dinner about 7 o'clock, and I laid down for a nap. Agnes went out on the front porch for some air. I woke up a little before 8 and went outside to look for her. She was gone.
Nobody saw her leave, Mr. Kelby?
Not that I know of. Maybe some of our nosy neighbors, I don't know.
How about your stepson? Wasn't he around Sunday night?
Bruce? No, went out to a show. Some other kids.
When did he get back from the show?
About 10, I think. Why?
Where's your stepson now?
Who are you looking for, my wife or my stepson?
Both, Mr. Kelby. Where's your stepson?
Gone. I took him over to my sister's in Alhambra. Been feeling bad since his mother disappeared. Figured the change would do him good.
When did you take him over to your sister's, Kelby?
This afternoon. What's that got to do with it?
We'd like to talk to Bruce.
No, I can't allow it. The boy's too upset. I can't allow it.
I'm afraid you're going to have to allow it.
Listen, mister, you can get off this property right now. No cops giving me sass.
Nobody's giving you sass, Kelby. We want to talk to your stepson, that's all. You might give us a clue as to the whereabouts of your wife.
And I say you can't see the boy. What's more, you cops couldn't find thorns in a rose patch. I'll get somebody else to look for Agnes. It's my business anyway. Nobody else's.
It's our business, too, if anything's happened to her.
What are you talking about?
You better get your coat, Mr. Kelby. We're taking you in for questioning.
You come through that gate, and I'm going to let these dogs go accidentally.
I'd hate to shoot the dogs. Now go on in the house and get your coat. Eric Kelby turned and made his way up the path and into the house. 5 minutes later, he came out. Without a word to either of us, he came down the path, closed the gate behind him, and got into our car. On the way back to headquarters, he chatted pleasantly about the weather, the nursery business, and his dogs. When we pulled up in front of the city hall, we met the reason for his sudden change in temperament. His lawyer was waiting for us at the door. We took Kelby to one of the interrogation rooms. His lawyer tagged along. We tried to question him, but the lawyer objected to 2 out of every 3 questions we asked. It was hopeless, and we knew it. So did the lawyer. We released Kelby, but we did get the name and address of his sister where the stepson Bruce was staying. After they left, Ben and I got back in the car and drove out to Alhambra to check on the boy.
McGiddy had this in pegged right, Joe. It's a real sleeper.
Yeah. I'd like to know how the stepson missed that date with us this afternoon.
Well, if the kid called us from the house, his stepfather could have overheard him.
It's possible. Sister's house ought to be along this block, shouldn't it?
Yeah, let's see. 1408, 1406. There it is, Joe. A great cottage, 1402.
Right. Well, it's a nice-looking little place, isn't it? Well-kept.
Yeah, it's a nice neighborhood. Wonder how the lot prices run out here. Somebody's coming.
Yes, what is it?
Police officers, ma'am. Are you Miss Kelby?
Bertha Kelby, yes, that's my name. Why?
We talked to your brother earlier today, Miss Kelby. He said that you brought his stepson, Bruce, here to stay for a while. We'd like to see him.
Bruce? Yes, he was here till about, an hour and a half ago. I went to the store, and when I came back, he was gone.
Have you any idea where he might be, Miss Kelby?
Well, I telephoned my brother Eric's place just before you came to the door. He's not there. I don't know where he might be. I'm worried about him. He seems so upset. This business about his mother's disappearance, you know.
Would you mind if we came in and looked around, Miss Kelby?
Well, no, not at all.
We went in and looked the house over from one end to the other. There wasn't a trace of the boy. We drove back to Kelby's nursery and satisfied ourselves the boy wasn't there. Then we came back to Alhambra and we kept an eye on Miss Bertha Kelby's home until midnight. No one came or went. At 5 minutes past midnight, the lights went off in the living room and a few minutes later in the back of the house. The next morning, when Ben and I checked in for work as usual at 8 o'clock, we met with Captain of Homicide, Frank Kearney.
What makes you two so positive there has been any foul play in this Kelby thing?
That's just it, Cap. We're not positive. It's a whole setup. It smells bad.
For instance?
That lawyer. If a man's innocent, he doesn't need a lawyer to sit with him in the interrogation room and tell him not to answer questions. Number 2, that kid's telephone call.
Maybe he doesn't get along with his stepfather. It happens, you know. Maybe he's trying to get back at him for something or other.
Maybe. Then why is Kelby hiding him out?
You're sure he's hiding him out?
No other way to take it, Cap.
The Kelby woman walked away from her home Sunday night. Nobody saw her. She took nothing with her. No clothes, no luggage, no money. You checked with the family doctor?
Yesterday. He told us Mrs. Kelby was in perfect health. We double-checked the wanderer's file and the repeater's file in missing persons. Couldn't find her name in either one.
How about her relatives in town?
Haven't had a chance to talk to them yet, Cap. We'll check them this morning.
Well, one thing's certain. The woman couldn't have gone very far.
We checked the sheriff's office, the jails, the hospitals.
We've sent out a teletype and an APB. Every cop in the city has her description. She's been gone almost 4 days, but nobody's seen her. How does that add up to you?
It doesn't. You better move on it. Check every one of Mrs. Calby's friends and relatives.
Right, Frank.
Then try the neighbors. As long as I've been a cop, neighbors have been able to tell everything about anyone.
All that day, Ben and I made the rounds. First stop was the Western National Bank, where Mrs. Calby maintained her account. Her savings statement showed a total balance of $31,564.17. Her separate checking account had a balance of $842.71. At the Farmers Mutual, we found the record of an insurance policy issued to Agnes Trumbull Kelby. It was a 20-pay life policy covering the insured in the amount of $30,000. The beneficiary was listed as the insured son, Bruce Trumbull Kelby, if living upon the receipt of such due proof. If not, the insured's husband, Eric J. Kelby. By the time we finished checking her financial status, the odds were piling up fast. From only casual reports, we knew that Eric Kelby was a frugal man. If he was greedy as well, if he wanted or needed money badly enough to kill, then he had all the motives necessary to murder his wife. Maybe his stepson, too. Ben and I started to make the rounds of Mrs. Kelby's friends and relatives. Our first stop was at the apartment of Agnes Kelby's sister, a talkative maiden lady in her early 60s.
Agnes just isn't that kind. Oh, I'm worried sick about this. I really am. And Bruce, the poor lad, he must be heartsick. And Eric, what does Eric say about all this?
He says he thinks his wife left him.
Left him? Why, that's ridiculous. How strange.
Can you think of any good reason why your sister would leave Mr. Kelby?
Why, no. They had tiffs, of course, small ones. But, of course, there was that argument about Bruce. The two of them always seem to be arguing about Bruce.
How do you mean, ma'am?
Oh, well, raising the boy and all, you know. The last time I talked to them, they were tiffing about whether or not Bruce should be paid for working in the nursery for Eric. And the strangest thing, Eric seemed to be so upset about it all. Imagine. All on account of paying the boy a few dollars for good, honest work in that silly nursery. Well, you know, I'm the outspoken kind, and I just told Eric. Eric, I said, don't be an old meanie. Pay the boy.
That was the extent of the information which Mrs. Kelby's sister had to offer. Next, we called on an aunt, Mrs. James D. Trumbull, 83 years old. She could hardly understand our questions, let alone answer them. She hadn't seen her niece, Agnes, in a year. After that, we paid a visit to one of Mrs. Kelby's friends, a Mrs. Lillian Humboldt.
Well, I'm sorry, Sergeant, but I can't think of any good reason why she would leave him. Unless that silly business about Bruce got out of hand. You know, maybe Eric is just a little jealous of the boy.
Next, we called on Daisy McLeod, who worked as a day maid for Mrs. Kelby.
Officer, what Mr. and Mrs. Kelby thought, what they said, what they did, it's none of my business. I come in the morning, I do my work, I do it well. I'm not the nosy type, and I don't pry. I take half an hour for lunch, and when I'm through, I take my pay, and I don't expect tips, and I take the boss home. I'm not the peeking through the keyhole kind, sneaking around corners listening. But what I couldn't tell you about that man...
Exactly what do you mean, Miss McLeod?
Oh, he's a hard man, you know. They're always arguing about the boy. Bruce this, Bruce that. He's a nice boy, I think. He's never done anything to me. Oh, but the arguments. Him and her all the time. Should the boy be paid for working? Shouldn't he? Why? Why not?
When Ben and I finished with a list of Mrs. Kelby's friends, relatives, and employees, we started out on the neighbors. None of them saw Mrs. Kelby after 6 p.m. the night she disappeared. Two of the neighbors said they saw the porch light burning after 7 p.m., but both said the porch was empty. Mrs. Kelby was not sitting in her chair at the usual time after dinner. According to them, that was one of her habits. It was 10 minutes to 6 by the time Ben and I got back to the office. The light was still burning in Captain Kearney's office.
Full day, Joe. A lot of mileage.
Yeah. I wonder what the captain's hanging around for.
Let's find out.
Get anything?
Pretty good luck, Cap.
Good. I've got some more for you. Just walked in 5 minutes ago.
What do you mean, Frank? Who walked in?
Bruce Kelby. He's waiting in the next room.
We went in the next room and met Bruce Kelby. He was small for a 17-year-old, dark-haired and a little on the sickly side. He told us that he couldn't keep the date he made with us on the phone because his stepfather apparently did overhear the conversation and drove him directly to his sister's home in Alhambra. We asked him why he was so sure that his stepfather was responsible for his mother's sudden disappearance.
For one thing, all three of us usually go to the early show on Sunday night. Eric, Mom, and me.
But last Sunday, Eric said he wasn't feeling good and he wanted Mom to stay home and take care of him. Then he told me to go on ahead to the show, so I did.
What time did you get home, son?
About 9:30, 9:45.
What was your stepfather doing when you got home?
Sitting in the living room, reading the paper.
Did you notice anything unusual about the way he acted?
He was nervous and jumpy, more than usual, I think.
Anything else?
Yes, sir. When I came in through the front yard, I noticed the dogs had mud all over their paws. They'd been out somewhere in the nursery plots. And they won't go out in the plots unless Eric's with them. He doesn't want them to trample the seedlings.
What would your stepfather be doing out in the nursery at night? Does he usually do some work at night?
No, sir. None of the plots are even lighted. Only the greenhouses.
And the paths in the greenhouses are usually graveled, aren't they? No mud around.
It's my job to see that the greenhouse paths are kept graveled. I know they're not muddy. I fixed them the day before, Saturday.
What do you think it means, son?
I don't know. I don't want to think about it. I just know he's done something. He's done something to her.
Did your stepfather give you any reason for keeping you away from the police officers the other day?
No, sir. He said people were getting nosy, and he said it might be better for me over at Aunt Bertha's. She's his sister.
Do you think your Aunt Bertha might know where your mother is?
No, we hardly ever see her. We don't know her well at all.
We've heard your mother and your stepfather argued about whether you should be paid for your work in the nursery.
When I started to work for him, he promised he'd pay me. I was saving up to buy a 31 Model A. And then after a couple of months, when he didn't pay me, I asked him. He told me I ought to be glad to work for him for nothing.
And your mother argued with him over that?
Sure, it was her money that bought the nursery anyway.
How'd you get away from your aunt's place last night?
Well, Bertha had some shopping to do and she left me alone. She locked the door to my room. Even the screen over the window in my room was nailed down, but I kicked it out and got away. I stayed at a friend's house last night.
Thought about where you're going to stay tonight?
I don't know. But I'm not going home. And I'm not going back to Bertha's place either. I'll get a room.
How'd you like to stay at my house a few days?
Sure nice of you, sir. Maybe I'd better not. Mom might not like it.
Oh, I'll take care of that. Now let's hop out and get some dinner.
Sure darn nice of you, sir.
All right, son. Come with me.
What do you think, Joe?
He could be lying. Yeah.
Now what, Cap? Shall we bring Kelby in again?
No, not yet. He's found out by now from his sister that the boy's gone. He probably figures the police station is the first place he'd come.
Wouldn't do much good pulling him in now, Ben. We couldn't even question him. 10-1 his lawyer'd be waiting for us when we got back.
That's the problem. How do we get to this Kelby without his lawyer finding out?
Well, what about the early morning, Cap? Say tomorrow, about 5 or 6 a.m. Think you'd be looking for us then?
Yeah, that might do it.
We can just get by that pack of hounds he owns without waking the whole neighborhood. Might work.
If we could just question him alone... I got an idea it wouldn't take much to make him cop out.
All right, give it a try. Get out there in the early morning and bring him in for questioning as quietly as possible. I'll be in at 6 a.m. If you want me before then, call me at home.
All right, Frank.
Kelby's got a smart lawyer. It's going to be plenty hard to convict him without a body and corroborating evidence.
He's got 4 acres out there, Cap. You can hide a lot of bodies in 4 acres.
Well, that's what I mean. This case isn't ending. It's just beginning.
The next morning, Ben and I met at the office about a few minutes past 4 a.m. We had a cup of coffee and a donut at an all-night restaurant, and then we started for the Kelby place out on Belasco Road. We took 4 pounds of fresh horse meat with us to keep the dogs quiet if they raised a fuss. It was 28 minutes past 4 when Ben pulled the car to a stop a few hundred feet from the gate to the Kelby nursery. We got out of the car and made our way down the road to the gate. I reached in and tried the latch. It was padlocked. The dog started in. Okay, Ben, looks like we'll have to jump the fence. Toss some of that horse meat over to him.
Yeah, here.
That's it. Come on, let's climb.
Keep an eye on those hounds. Looks like they could chew your leg off.
Yeah. Here comes a third one, Ben. Toss some more meat.
Yeah, there you are, boy. Go get it. Go get it, boy.
Look, Ben, light's going on in the house.
Come on, let's make it fast.
Who is it? Who's there? I'll set the dogs on you.
Police officers, Mr. Kelby.
What? What are you doing out here this time of night?
You're under arrest, Kelby. Get your coat.
You cops are asking for a peck of trouble.
Get your coat.
Where's my stepson? What have you done with him?
What have you done with your wife?
You're going to pay for this. I'll have your jobs.
That's not the first time we heard that, Kelby. Let's go. Lights burning in the captain's office.
Yeah. All right, Kelby, in here.
I'll pay for this, mark my word.
Ben, take him in the office here and stay with him. I'll see if Frank's in yet.
Right, Joe. Come on, Kelby, inside.
Friday, did you bring in Kelby?
He's down in the interrogation room. Ben's with him.
Somebody saw you.
Don't think so.
They must have. Kelby's lawyer's sitting in the next room.
Kelby again refused to answer any questions without the advice of his attorney. We released him. That day, Captain Kearney sent out two men to keep an eye on the nursery and report on all of Kelby's movements. Shortly after 7 o'clock that night, just after nightfall, we tried once again to bring in Kelby for questioning without his lawyer's knowledge. It didn't work. A little after we booked him, his lawyer obtained a writ of habeas corpus. We had to release him again. The two men assigned to stake out the Kelby place reported definitely that somebody was tipping the lawyer whenever unknown visitors showed up at the nursery and drove off with Kelby. There was nothing we could do about it. The next morning, Kearney came up with a lead.
I had a long talk with the boy last night. Accidentally, I think he's given us a pretty good lead.
Yeah?
There's only one way we'll ever get a conviction. That's by finding the body and evidence to tie Kelby in.
Yeah, that'll do it. Where do we start looking?
In a new rose bed next to one of the greenhouses in Kelby's nursery.
Hmm?
The kid came up with it last night.
How come?
First, Kelby's crazy about saving a dollar and making one.
Yeah.
In the nursery trade, especially where you have a limited area to work in, like Kelby, you cultivate every foot of ground. Every bit of soil you got is planted with something.
Mm-hmm.
Kelby's not the type to waste anything. Especially he's not the kind that would let ground lie fallow when he could plant something that might bring in a few dollars next season. Bruce tells me his stepfather has every inch of those 4 acres planted. Every inch. Except a 6 by 9 foot plot of ground in that rose garden.
Well, that sounds like a long shot to me, Frank.
The boy said he prepared that piece of ground for planting late Saturday afternoon. His stepfather wanted it ready for Sunday morning. The plot of ground still vacant.
Might have planted it yesterday, Cap. When's the last time you checked?
Before I came to work this morning. I called the men on stakeout next to the nursery. They told me the plot's still empty.
Mm-hmm. It's worth a chance, Frank. When do we look it over?
Tonight. I don't want Kelby or his lawyer to know a thing until we find that body.
Well, how are we going to work it?
We'll order up a crew from the crime lab. They can take probings through that plot and all around it. They can tell us without any guesswork how deep that ground's been worked over lately.
When do you want to start?
Be here in the office at 8:30 tonight. If my hunches are any good, we'll find a body.
It was 9:10 that night when we got to the Kelby place. Lieutenant Lee Jones and his assistants, Kearney, Ben, and two other men from homicide. The men on stakeout told us that Kelby had left about 20 minutes before in a dark blue coupe. Ben brought along the usual supply of horse meat for the dog, so we didn't have any trouble there. We found the empty plot of ground in the rose bed next to the greenhouse, exactly as Bruce described it to Kearney.
Ground's been worked over all right, boys. At least 4 to 5 feet down.
All right, Lee, let's start digging. Romero, take care of the dogs. Watson, grab one of these shovels.
Right, Cap.
Hey, Kelby said these dogs were vicious, didn't he?
Yeah, why?
Look at these hounds. They're no more vicious than a lively colt, look.
Higgins, get that light over here, will you? Thanks.
What is it, Lee?
Let me see. Teeth. Set of false teeth.
Been in the ground long?
Don't think so, judging from the shape they're in.
How far down would you say you are, Lee?
A couple of feet. Ground's real soft.
Lee, come here a minute.
What is it?
Body. Here's the shoulder.
All right, you men over here with Watson. Get the dirt off the face. Romero, you got a picture of the Kelby woman?
Yeah, Cap. Let's see. Oh, here it is.
Thanks. Get the light down here.
Hunch paid off, Frank. That's her. Ben and I went back to the car and notified communications to broadcast a want for murder on Eric Kelby. His description, together with a description of the car and license number of the car he was driving, was rebroadcast every 15 minutes. Then we went back to check the house. We found the front door unlocked. We went inside and looked around. In one bedroom, we found clothes scattered over the bed and the floor. There was only one old suit remaining in the closet. On the table next to the bed, we found an airline's timetable. We got to the phone and notified communications to alert all police details at railroad stations, bus terminals, and airlines, and then to send out an APB on the teletype. After that, we checked with the airlines. One of them told us that a man answering Kelby's description had booked passage for Mexico City. The plane was scheduled to take off at 10:40 that night from Burbank Airport. Ben's watch said 4 minutes past 10. We called the detail at the airport and alerted them. Then we drove over to check in person. It was 10:35 p.m. when Ben and I took up our positions just inside Gate 3, where passengers were boarding Flight 72 for Mexico City.
He's cutting it close, Joe. Got about 4 minutes more to make that plane.
We waited. The crowd got thicker as departure time came closer. At 10:39, Eric Kelby came through the main entrance, across the terminal, through Gate 3, into a pair of handcuffs.
I don't understand. What does this mean?
We found your wife's body, Kelby.
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
In the rose patch next to the greenhouse. Your lawyer can't help this time.
Mexico City. Would have been a nice trip. Expensive.
I'll plead insanity. I didn't know what I was doing.
Be a nice vacation next year, Joe, Mexico City. I'm going to talk to my wife about it.
I didn't mean it. She slapped me. We were arguing about the boy. I didn't mean it.
I don't know if you did or not, Kelby, but you killed her. Come on. You missed your plane.
The story you have just heard is true. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
Eric Kelby was tried and convicted of murder in the first degree. He is now awaiting execution in the lethal gas chamber at the state penitentiary. You have just heard the 14th in a new series of authentic cases transcribed from official files. Technical advice for Dragnet comes from the office of W.A. Wharton, Acting Chief of Police, Los Angeles Police Department.
Tonight's program is dedicated to William J. Weston, Jr. of the Washington, D.C. Police Department, who on the evening of March 4th, 1945, gave his life so that yours might be more secure. Dragnet came to you from Los Angeles. If you enjoyed tonight's production of Dragnet, you'll want to listen to Richard Diamond, private detective, as played by the screen's romantic tough guy, Dick Powell.
The Pet Milk Show, usually heard at this time, has moved to a new time period on Sunday nights. Be sure to hear Larry Douglas and Kay Armon on the new Pet Milk Show tomorrow night on NBC. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.
Well, it's that time again. Time to pull the plug on another week of old-time radio here on the RTC Weekly Download. But we'll be back next week.